O'Bruni, O'Bruni. The gentle teasing rang out behind me. Hello, how are you? I said bravely and kept on walking, not quite sure if I caught any edge in their calls or if, like so many Ghanaians, they were just being friendly. O'Bruni, which is their word for white person, carries no malice. It's a greeting, an endearment. In the villages, children flock around white strangers and chant, O'Bruni, O'Bruni, with big smiles and outstretched arms. It's a game, we're the fun. But these were not children chanting. These were young adults on the campus of the University of Ghana, where our oldest son, Colin, was spending a year studying abroad. My spouse, Mary, and I, and our younger son, Michael, were visiting over winter break in 2008. On this morning, I had gone off on an errand by myself. As I returned to campus, the gate was crowded with street vendors and others. These were the gleeful chanters of O'Bruni. But glee is sometimes deceiving, and so I walked kind of a gauntlet. Earlier, I had told Colin that though I was aware of our difference in Africa, I was having a hard time shrugging off my Caucasian mindset. I didn't feel like a minority, though I was. In that moment, though, I was overwhelmingly aware of my skin. It was as if I were lit up, shining, unable to blend into the crowd. The best I could do was to keep my head down and my eyes straight forward. A little ways down the road and out into an open area, the calls drifted away and I was alone again, moving rapidly to cut down my exposure. Then up from behind came a tall, thin man who settled into stride next to me. Hello, I am Robert. I am from Nigeria. Hello, I am David, I said, telling him my name, but not much more. Some more polite conversation, and I saw that his gait was labored. Though I kept up my aggressive pace, he struggled along with a bandaged and grossly swollen left foot, elephantiasis. I swallowed and kept on walking. I have been to the hospital, he continued very pleasantly, but I need 15 CDs, which was a little more than $15, for medicine. I don't know where I will get the money. Can you help me, David? Fishing about a dollar's worth of change from my pocket, I handed it to him. I'm sorry, Robert, this is all I have. That was a lie. Deeper in my clothes, I had another 40 CDs, but I didn't want to dig for them, not in this open public place. The last thing I wanted right then was to attract even more attention. And more, I needed to save this money. My credit cards were not working in this country. I could get just a little bit out of the bank each day, not nearly enough to cover our room and board. So I was forced into a routine of saving as much as I could in hopes of hoarding enough to pay for our rooms at the end of the stay. A crowd of evil thoughts collected. How did I know Robert's medication would cost him $15? Or that it would cure him, or that he would even use the money for medicine. A handful of change would buy him some food, and that would get him through another day, one day, or maybe the rest of his life. No matter how much I tried, I told myself I could not eliminate Robert's disease, so easing his load in whatever small way was doing something. That's kindness, right? I gripped the bag in my hand. My errand that morning was crashing into the circumstance of the moment. I had gone off to a small pharmacy outside of campus in search of medicine of a different kind. Michael, who had boarded the plane with a ferocious head cold, had over a couple of days developed a full-blown sinus infection. It threatened to cripple our trip. That day, we had scrapped plans for a more extensive tour, and I went off by myself across Africa, or at least a small part of it, fortified by a singularity of purpose. I went in search of antibiotics. They were amazingly easy to find. For $20, I bought a full run of amoxicillin over the counter with no prescription. I walked away feeling complicit in something. Now, the $20, the relativity between my $20 of medication and the $15 worth of medication this Nigerian said he needed was clouding my mind. Did I pay the Obruni rate for my drugs? Was he receiving a subsidized African rate? Were 15 CDs even really what he needed? How much does stuff cost anyway? I need to rest, Robert said. You should rest, Robert. Rest under this tree. I jumped at a chance to get myself out of this dilemma. We walked on. He talked some more. I am dying, David. I am dying. I'm sorry, Robert. I cannot help you. I have wrestled with this story for going on 5 years now, maybe longer if you think of the wrestling apart from its circumstance. It seems like a monstrous failure on my part. How do I respond? What is my role? And now, what have I learned? How can I be different? I bet you have Roberts of your own. Maybe not quite as far away, but somewhere, sometime, someone must have asked you on the street for some money. Even if by chance this has never happened to you, you must know of it, and I don't mean to assume too much. Maybe you too have been in a position where it was necessary to ask for help, to rely on the kindness of strangers or friends or family. So what do you do? How do you respond? Maybe, as I did, you ask yourself, how do I know this person won't just buy booze? In fact, a man who approached me outside my door here in Rockford a couple of weeks ago seemed to want to reassure me that that would not be the case. He went to some length about how he needed just a couple of bucks for bus fare so that he could get to a job. Any doubt was completely unspoken by me, but nevertheless, it was real enough in our culture to cause him to try to justify himself right off the bat. Maybe what you say is, no, I won't give you money, but I will buy you a meal. Maybe there's a Burger King nearby. This takes more effort. Giving money to someone who is hungry is one thing, but actually sitting down to a meal with them is quite another. There's time involved here and some interpersonal capital to be spent. Maybe instead of giving money to some person, you say you work instead at a food pantry or in a soup kitchen, or even better, you work for systemic change to crush the conditions that cause people to have to beg. That, we might say, uses class privilege for good. It works to transform our world. And then there is a kind of a hyperbolic argument, as sometimes we ask ourselves, where does it end? There is so much poverty out there. There is so much need. I can't possibly begin to fix it. No matter how much I try, I could literally give away everything I have. And for what? I feed this argument, I know, by bringing you a story from Africa. The world is incredibly large. The need is unspeakably great. I might have just used an example from outside my door, but that would have compressed the issue to something smaller, some aspect of our culture or our economy that we think we can fix. What I have come to now, with the help of Robert and a lot more reflection and a particular seminary professor who was tuned into these issues, now when I am faced with someone asking for money, I just give it to them. I just give. I think, Who am I to say what that person really needs? Who am I to say that they need a hot meal or a shower or a prayer or to hear me preach a sermon about how I think the world ought to be? Who am I to say that what they really need is not just a 40 ounce? Because really, if you're living on the street, if you've been down so long, wouldn't a beer taste pretty good? In fact, the distance between us might not be all that great. I am lucky. I am privileged. I can spend some money, not a lot, but I'm okay. But on the curve, I'm a lot closer to that person on the street than I am to joining the 1%. I bet most of us here are too. The new truth is that all of us are just one shutdown, one downturn, one foreclosure, one unemployment check away from that person on the street. There is real evidence, too, that the more high-minded efforts at aid might not actually work as well as simply handing over cash. A couple of months ago, NPR reported on a charity called Give Directly that's trying to help poor people in the developing world in an unusual way, by sending them money with no strings attached. The idea is simple. Poor people know what they need, and if you give them money, they will buy it. As an experiment, researchers gave money to a group of people in Kenya to see what they would do with it. Guess what? Instead of buying alcohol or tobacco, they invested in their kids' education. They invested in health care. They bought more and better food. They bought cows. They started businesses. Their kids went hungry less often. And even though the Kenyan study showed that people still got sick and their kids didn't necessarily go to school, there were improvements in mental health. Getting money made people happier, less stressed out. Duh. Now, I do also try to work for systemic change. In truth, my efforts here are a little more scattered. I have the luxury as a white person in America of going home at night and leaving the work behind. But I do believe that only giving money is not enough. I think it takes more. Giving needs help from learning, from organizing, from speaking out, from telling the truth. And there is still more. It doesn't just end there. There is a deeper lesson, a lesson in giving, in generosity, in a generous spirit. Henry David Thoreau says, "If you would give money, spend yourself with it." That passage from the book of Luke that I read earlier, in which Jesus tells a potential disciple to let the dead bury their own dead, that's pretty harsh. Telling a potential disciple to leave his own father to rot is even worse than it sounds now. Funeral rites then were core to Jewish belief. There was a profound obligation to bury one's father. To do otherwise is to blaspheme your father, your family, your culture, your whole tradition. This is not simply a suggestion from Jesus to reorder your priorities. This is really an unreasonable demand. This is either or, and I don't like it at all. I am much more a both and kind of guy. But there it is, like Robert, bugging me, reminding me of something. This passage happens in a long section called the Journey Narrative that begins as Jesus sets his face toward Jerusalem, which is the author's way of telling us that Jesus knows he's going to die. Jerusalem is where they killed prophets in those days. It's like us saying we're going to take that walk down the Green Mile or go sleep with the fishes or tag along with Frodo on his march toward Mordor. Jesus, or more properly, the writer of Luke, is making it clear that these are dangerous times. The call for commitment is uncompromising. Jesus is telling anyone who would go with him that they're going to have to give up everything they've got, maybe even their lives. And by the way, we're leaving right now. Let the dead bury the dead. In parallel form, Robert on that plane in Africa says something just as radical. He says to me, "The hell with your family. Leave them right here, right now, half a world away from what you know. You say you can't pay for your nice clean rooms and soft beds and breakfast in the morning. Look at me. I'm sleeping in the dirt, eating mush. You say your kid has a head cold? Look at my foot." That kind of shock value is what this passage in Luke is all about. It is often used to describe the kind of deep commitment of Christian discipleship. Now, I'm not asking you to take up your cross and follow Jesus, but I can see in this passage what my own beliefs mean, what they require. What this passage means for me is that to be real, to be authentic, for faith to be real, to be who we truly are, we have to be all in. We have to give till it hurts, give all we've got. It is a call to action. Right now, we're leaving. Leave everything else behind. These are dangerous times. That's what our liberal faith demands. Liberal faith means that we must work at what we believe in for it to become real. It means we must align our ideas and our actions. We must live our faith. Good is not a thing that's out there ready for us to stumble upon, not any more than evil is independent of us, wandering around looking for mischief. Both good and evil come from human action, from human agency. We are the makers, the doers. We give good and evil meaning. Unitarian theologian James Luther Adams names this. He says, "We deny the Immaculate Conception of virtue and affirm the need for social incarnation." Let me break that down. We deny the Immaculate Conception of virtue. That means that goodness doesn't just pop into being. It is not born without struggle. The good is not independent. It is not a thing. Good is a value, a quality. Giving is good. The need for social incarnation means goodness must be made real in relationship. It means that truth with a capital T comes not in isolation, but in community, in interaction. There is no easy grace here. We have to work at it. And the need for work in us is deep. A person longs for work that is real. Some days after I left Robert on that field, Mary mentioned that she and Colin had come upon a man with a swollen foot on campus. It had to be Robert, I thought. Colin gave him some money, Mary said. Of course, Colin knows the rules. Colin understands who to help, how much to give, how not to look like an easy target, how the sons shall pay for the sins of the fathers. I failed Robert, but he did not fail me. His gift was to show me a bit more of myself, how I might be different. Grace lies in the very next moment. It lies in the ability to choose to move ourselves into a greater understanding, to be other than who we are, other than who we have been. Grace lies in the ability to learn to give. Give. Live. Love. Move. More and more. I am grateful for Robert in his debt. There is no easy grace here. I need to work at it. I need to reach down inside my clothes and find what I have to give.